Hello everyone and welcome to Module 15 of Advanced Aromatherapy, Therapeutic Application of Essential Oils for Clarity, Health, and Happiness with David Crow, titled Essential Oils, Essential Oil Uses for Pregnancy, Children, and the Elderly. This is your host, Colleen at the Shift Network. Just a couple reminders. Our next class will be next year, Wednesday, January 11th, so that will be in 2 weeks. And if you need any technical assistance and you're on the phone, please press 5. If you're on the webcast, please type directly into the box and provide your email so we can email you back. That covers it for today. Let's bring on David and get started. Welcome, David.
Thank you again, Colleen, and welcome back to everybody. I hope you have had a wonderful holiday season, however you do it. And let's go ahead and get started with our usual routine of looking at webcast questions here. Several really good ones came in last week that I didn't have time to answer. So if you go to the course page and you click on the link for Module 15, where we are today, you can see that there's a file for webcast questions from Module 14 last week. Let's go ahead and open that up. And several other things have come in already. So if we look at the questions from last week, let's just go through these very briefly because we have a lot to cover. We have some things from last week. The sacred sense for supporting meditation is not quite done, and I gave everybody a little homework assignment that we should also discuss. So let's go through these quickly. Love the mystical properties. Would you ever do a class on something like that? And yes, of course, I do love the mystical properties also. It's one of my favorite topics, and as those who are in the 7 and 12 week medicinal plants and spiritual evolution courses know, that was something that we unpacked quite a bit. Covered from some slightly different angles also. And there is a very good likelihood that we could definitely do something specifically devoted to this topic. I like doing this topic in a live event because there are so many wonderful things to pass around. Nice aromatic woods and resins and so forth. Okay, let's look at next question, taking the safety precautions into consideration in regard to wintergreen and birch. In the case of a normal healthy person with a hematoma that is taking a while to heal, is this appropriate use of wintergreen or birch in high dilution means low concentration, to help thin the blood to eliminate the bruising and or hard lump that is often present afterwards with a hematoma, and that is fine. That's exactly the best scenario for birch and wintergreen, but I would also suggest helichrysum as number one, as it is specifically for resolving bruising. And helichrysum and frankincense go together very well. So you can use either or both. I wouldn't necessarily suggest throwing them all together. You could. There's nothing wrong with making a blend of birch and helichrysum and frankincense. That's actually very good. I would personally just tend to use helichrysum more and more frequently because it's much safer. And it's just a better oil for resolving bruises in general. Another question here, what are good oils and blends for mourning, which is different than depression? So with this, the way that I chose to answer it is, let's shift our thinking here a little bit, okay? Because we could say, well, what's the best oil for this, or what's the best blend for this? Now, when it comes to emotional states, as we have learned, there are so many different ways that we could approach this. And so the suggestion that I have is let's think holistically about the overall effects of the olfactory system. And that's a much more open-ended answer. Because if we think of it more like how do fragrances affect our moods, then it gives us a huge palette to choose from. Because really, as we know by now, aromatherapy is very subjective, and especially with emotions. Now, if it were really a clear picture of cause and effect between this oil does this, then it'd be a lot easier, but it isn't. And the reason that it isn't is because it's through the sense of smell. And because it's through the sense of smell, it's through the limbic system, which of course is governed by our subjective liking and disliking. And so we could say, yes, there are certain oils that you might choose, and I've given this list here. Two primary groups of oils that have the best potential, in my opinion anyway, flowers and the sacred scents that we're talking about in the beginning of this module, such as frankincense and Palo Santo and agarwood. All of these that have spiritual purposes and spiritual dimensions are a first choice for any kind of mental and emotional suffering, and the flowers are also because of their general mood uplifting effects. But we also know that there's a very strong correlation between comfort and pleasure and emotional security and fragrances of foods. As I have mentioned, one of the greatest anxiolytic or relaxing fragrances that was discovered for patients going into an MRI tube is vanilla. So the question then is, which is the best is not really the best way to even approach it. Because I could say something like, well, of all the flower fragrances, rose probably has the most, the longest reputation and the most association with healing grief. And if you were to say, what's the number one oil for healing grief? I would say rose. Or I would say maybe it's frankincense or maybe it's agarwood. But these are first choices. But then the question becomes much more open-ended, and the question really is, what about just using aromatherapy in general? What if it's not one specific oil, but what if it is just continual exposure to nice fragrances? And then if we consider that this is actually providing our sense of awareness, our sense organ, with a lot of pleasant stimuli, we could then extend that, and we could say, well, what about the other senses? And we could therefore say that for treating mourning and grief and loss, maybe you could also add in nice music, or you could add in the sounds of nature, sitting at the beach listening to the ocean, or in a forest listening to the sound of the trees and the birds. And then what about the sense of taste, and how does food affect us? When we're in certain kinds of emotional states, and what kinds of foods will help us the most. And then what about our sense of sight? Well, undoubtedly having certain things to look at in terms of uplifting beauty of nature or spiritual art or things like that. That's the whole role of visualization, as I explained last week in spiritual practice. All the senses can be involved. And if all the senses are involved, then it isn't really a question so much of what does what. It's more of a question of how do we support ourselves during a difficult time. And obviously, the more we can do through the outer senses, the more the inner world will be supported. Now, of course, there are many kinds of loss and grief and mourning to different degrees that last different lengths of time that affect people in different ways. That happen at different times of life. And quite honestly, there are many things that happen that people never really fully recover from, and we just live with them. And they become part of us. They become part of how we view the world. They become part of the experiences that we have gone through. And it doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing either, because people who have been through tremendous hardship and suffering frequently learn the greatest spiritual lessons, and they come to terms with things at a very deep level. So I would say the simple answer is what I've listed here, the flowers and the sacred scents, but I would encourage everybody not to think in these terms, especially with aromatherapy. What oil does this for this emotion? It's so individual. We really can't narrow it down that way. For example, what if you don't like rose because you have an unpleasant childhood memory of rose that was associated with some unpleasant circumstances? Well, then it just doesn't work. And so therefore, Let's think about it as more of an overall nourishing of our sense organs and using the sense of smell to support our overall well-being. And this includes all of our sense organs. All right, I hope that's helpful. Regarding the question about using oils that are years old, just to reiterate here, essential oils don't ferment or go rancid. They do oxidize, and some oils can oxidize relatively quickly, especially if they're exposed to heat or sun. Now, the question was, is it okay to still use older oils in a diffuser? And is it different than being applied topically? Well, yes. Oxidized oils become more allergenic, and people can react to them adversely. And I personally think this is one of the reasons why a lot of people are getting adverse reactions to essential oils, because first of all, they're not using them correctly. They're putting them on diluted on the skin, but you can have a whole range of reactions from oils depending on whether they have been distilled within that year or whether they have been sitting on a shelf for a few years. And oils that are very common, such as lavender and tea tree and so forth, can oxidize and they can produce dermotoxic reactions, not because they're bad oils, but just because they're older oils. So keep that in mind. And so the reaction on the skin is a much more likely occurrence. Now, some people can still get some sensitivities to essential oils in a diffuser, but it's much less. I think at this point everybody should understand that if you put essential oils on your skin, it's high risk. And if you put essential oils in a diffuser, it's low risk. And so therefore using them in a diffuser also decreases the risk of any kind of sensitive reactions if the oil is not that fresh. So would you like to use older oils? Well, it's always better to use them fresh. But if you have some nice oils and you've had them around for a while, there's a likelihood that they have oxidized. Just don't put them on the skin. Will they hurt you in the diffuser? The risk is relatively low. Good question coming next. If I had to pick 5 or 6 essential oils to travel, what would I take with me? I suggested lavender and or geranium because these are good overall relaxing oils that help with sleep and relaxation during stressful times of travel. Helichrysum, obviously, for its wound healing powers. Frankincense, for its wound healing powers. And also because it's really nice just to freshen up a room. It's a type of oil you can just take in a funky motel room and just sprinkle it around and freshen a room up. Tea tree and or niuli, oravansar, obviously, for protecting the respiratory system from external pathogens, colds and flus, sore throats and all that. Eucalyptus or a conifer, same reason. Palo Santo, same reason. Now, those are a few basic suggestions, but again, this is very individual. I'm sure by now, since we've gone through many modules, you're seeing how many oils there are out there and how flexible they are to use. This is not herbal medicine. Aromatherapy is very generalized. Aromatherapy is very individual. You can use oils in all kinds of different ways. You've undoubtedly learned this by now. And you also have a lot to choose from depending on where you're going. And so if you're going on a spiritual pilgrimage, maybe you would like to take some spiritual oils like sandalwood and some of the attars. Or if you're going somewhere romantic, you're going to Venice, to the canals of Venice or whatever, Venice, Italy, maybe you'd like to take some rose and jasmine or whatever. So you can put together your pharmacy according to where you're going. You can take more of the respiratory oils if you're going to a place that's highly polluted and so forth. Okay, nice long statement at the end all about the customer service and all these kind of things. What's relevant here? Good feedback, but I did want to touch on one thing. It appears that there's a little bit of confusion between flower essences and essential oils, and I just wanted to clarify that. Flower essences are not essential oils, and therefore they are not going to taste anything like taking essential oils in water, which this person is referring to. And the question then is, well, what are flower essences? And the simple answer is that they're at the complete opposite range of concentration. Essential oils are the most concentrated form of herbal medicine, And flower essences are in the realm of homeopathic subtle remedies. So the essential oils are pure molecules. Flower essences are pure vibration. Flower essences are made in an alchemical, energetic kind of way, which is taking the flowers and putting them on the surface of water to infuse under sunlight for several hours. And the idea behind this is how this was first propagated, of course, by, I believe it was Richard Bach. I don't know if I got his first name right, but everybody has probably heard of the Bach flower remedies. And this way of preparing flower essences actually has its roots in old alchemical history, and different cultures have gathered dew from different plants and believe that it has had certain kinds of subtle energetic properties infused within it and so forth. So flower essences are an energetic imprint made from a combination of the flower's life force, its prana, and the prana of the water and the prana of the sunlight. It has no taste other than the alcohol that preserves it, and it is totally different than the essential oils. So I wanted to clarify that. All right, that's for the webcast questions from last week, and let's see if there's anything real important. Okay, well, something just came in related to what I just got done saying here, talking about the vibrations in nature sound. Will I address the vibrational aspect of essential oils? Okay, well, sure. This is a common question, and it is one of the myths that is propagated on the internet, saying that essential oils have vibrations. Well, everything has vibration, but the way that it is propagated on the internet is scientifically inaccurate. This is one of the numerous things that has been perpetuated through multi-level marketing as a way of making people believe that the oils that a particular company has are utterly, completely different than the oils that everyone else has. That's a standard marketing strategy. Only our oils have these high vibrations. Only these oils are therapeutic grade. Everybody else's are not. Okay, well, that's marketing. That's marketing strategy. You have to set yourself apart as a company. Well, the concept or the idea that was floating around, and it has sort of quieted down now, but for a long time it was being passed around on the internet for a long time, that rose oil is the highest vibration. And so I've had many discussions with people in audiences and with scientists and have done research on it. And when people say an essential oil has vibration, then the first thing that we have to analyze is it a subjective experience or is it a physical objective experience? Because if you're talking about an essential oil having a vibration at an objective level, then you have to say, well, how is it being measured? Now, the statement that has been traveling around for a while is that it's measured in megahertz, okay, that it's measured in a radio frequency, but this is simply not possible to do. There are claims that a person has found a machine that can measure an essential oil in megahertz, but according to my research and discussion with scientists about it and many other aromatherapy experts, if you could actually find a machine that transformed an essential oil into a radio frequency that could be measured, you'd probably get a Nobel Prize. So one scientist explained it to me. He said, yes, you can measure the vibration of essential oils, but in order to do that, you would actually have to rent the particle accelerator at Stanford University, which would cost you $500,000 to do the test. So there's a lot of confusion about this, and let's just wrap it up and say it's one of the common myths that has been floating around for a while, that essential oils have vibrations. Now, that's at the scientific level. That's what scientists would say. They would say you cannot measure an essential oil in megahertz. It can't be done. Now, we can also look at it from the side of the subjective experience, and we can say that anything that is being perceived has some level of a vibration to it. Our food, the way it tastes could be described as a vibratory experience, or the sounds that we're hearing, touch, and so forth. And at that level, it's perfectly acceptable and perfectly viable to describe things in terms of vibration. But what's important here is let's not get the two subjects of objective and subjective confused here. So to answer the question very briefly, there's no real vibrational aspect of essential oils to address. What there is the chemical aspect and the physiological aspect. And mostly what we're talking about in this course is the physiological aspects of, okay, if you use the oils, they're going to affect your limbic system this way, they're going to affect your circulation this way, they're good for this symptom, they're good for this kind of mood, they're good for these therapeutic benefits. We could translate that into different kinds of subjective experiences at a vibrational level, but we can't really say, well, this oil has vibration. What we can say, if you want to go back to Module 2, is that there are quality control issues. And we could say that, okay, if an oil is a very high quality oil, that it has a higher level in every dimension, actually. It has a higher level of quality chemically, therapeutically, better effect on our body, mind, and spirit, and so forth. And so we could translate that into a vibration and say, well, it's a higher vibration than a synthetic fragrance, but that's a subjective interpretation. Okay, I will stop. Now, I gave everybody a little bit of a homework assignment, and this will help us transition into our module today about oils for children, women, and the elderly, and that was the question about what can you find that relates to using oils that are either dangerous or helpful for seizures. And somebody has posted here, thank you for the class assignment that you did, and here's a good list to start us off with. Now I'm going to just go ahead and read this, and we'll open the file on what I found, and we'll talk about it in more detail. So what this person found is to avoid, with a susceptibility to seizures, the problem compounds are camphor. Excellent. That's very helpful to know. Camphor is found in sage oil, rosemary oil, spike lavender, and camphor oil. That's very good to know. And so last week I mentioned that one of the problematic oils to think about would be rosemary. But I was thinking about it more from its overall effects, not from the chemistry. But it's one way to look at it, and that is something that we also find when we get into chemotypes, is that certain types of rosemary have higher camphor levels. So another one, and this one is probably the most important overall, is thujone. That's T-H-U-J-O-N-E, which is found in cedar leaves, okay, primarily in the green cedar leaves, and that oil is called thujone oil. It's also found in certain chemotypes of hyssop and in tansy. And then there is pinocamphone, which is found in hyssop and wormwood, and methyl salicylate, which is found in birch and wintergreen. So this is a good preliminary list. Now let's go to the course page and click on Module 15, and you will see the list of papers that I have posted. Now, don't get alarmed. There's a lot of scientific studies here. But I'm just going to scan through all of these very quickly. Let's open the file called Essential Oils and Seizures. And what you're going to see here is very interesting because the reports are actually contradictory. I'll give everybody a minute to go ahead and open that up. And let's just scan through this. I'll give you the five-minute version. So the first category that you come across if you're doing research on this, this is from the medical databases. The first category is that you find that there's essential oils that are actually anticonvulsant. That's good to know. Next category is you find that there are oils that are convulsant. They are a high risk. But here's what's confusing. Some of the information is the same. Some of the oils, apparently in some studies, are good for reducing seizures, and in other studies, they stimulate them. Now, why is there so much confusion? Everybody should know the answer to that. Essential oils have not been around for thousands of years. Essential oils have only emerged in modern scientific awareness in the last few decades. Empirical evidence has been around for several centuries, but this is totally different than herbal medicine. Herbal medicine has been used for thousands and thousands of years. Essential oils as a concentrated extract, relatively new. And furthermore, there has been an explosion in the number of species that are being distilled just in the last 10 years. And so that's why this information is very, very new and very, very confusing. That's why we get contradictory results. So the first one here, it is looking at the monoterpene linalool. And that's something that's found in a lot of essential oils. It's found in clary sage, it's found in lavender. But what's the conclusion? The tested doses were safe, no motor impairment. Clear anti-nociceptive, in other words, pain-reducing, and anti-convulsant potential. Okay, so the oils then that are mostly in the flower category would be those that would have this anti-convulsant property. And here's another one, the next one. Anti-convulsant activity of neroli. Results. Okay, more linalool. Results suggest that neroli possesses biologically active constituents that have anti-convulsant activity, which supports the ethno-medicinal claims of the use of the plant in the management of seizure. Well, that's very interesting. They're not saying essential oil of neroli has been used for centuries for, reducing the frequency of seizure. It says the plant has this reputation. All right, that's a good way that we link modern science to traditional ethnobotanical medicine. Okay, now here's another one. This is Artemisia draculus, and that's actually tarragon. And tarragon has been used in Iranian folkloric medicine as an anti-epileptic remedy. And so what do they say? It says, observed anti-convulsant and sedative effects could be related to the presence of monoterpenoids in the essential oils. What's curious about it is that the same compounds, okay, that they're pointing to, have also been found to be convulsant. We don't have to get into these complexities, but for those of you who are scientifically oriented, these kinds of studies are very important to consider. So here's another one. Clove oil. Well, you wouldn't think that clove oil would actually reduce frequency of seizures, but apparently it does in mice. And I'm sorry that most of these studies are done on animals, and they're not very pleasant. But it's important to see, well, okay, this is where the science is coming from also, because obviously you can't test these things on human beings very easily. Okay, you can't, you know, ethically or legally subject people to higher and higher doses of exposure until they start getting seizures. Okay, let's look now at the next one, which basically is a whole list of various oils. There's rosemary, holy basil, mint, a couple different types of mints, and so forth. And all groups of mice treated with the essential oils showed reduced activity and stability, except from oregano oil, which had 100% mortality. That's something important to consider just in itself. Then they found that mice who were given the peppermint oil had no seizures and 100% survival. Well, that's very contradictory information, because in other studies we see that mint oil is problematic. So this is just for you to think about. Here's another good one, lemongrass. And I gave you a monograph of lemongrass this week, and the lemongrass is anticonvulsant. So many, many things actually were found to be anticonvulsant. Now let's answer the specific question. We come to convulsant with increased risk. And here are the same compounds. Now, one of the things that I want to say about these oils that I have already listed as potentially dangerous, these are not oils that you are learning in this course. I am not teaching you dangerous oils. But now we're going to go on a little tangent, and I'm going to mention some names. And these essential oils are things you should know about, but there's only a few of these that are actually presented in the course. And therefore, we're going to separate those out, and you're going to know, yes, they're very important oils, and you have the monographs on how to use them, but you're also going to understand that these should not be used under certain conditions. And the oils that are listed here, we start with a report of a toxicity case of sage oil. And sage oil has thujone, camphor, and cineol in different proportions. Now, what's complicated about this, cineol is a major compound in eucalyptus oil and lots of other oils. Does that mean that eucalyptus oil is convulsant? Well, no. You see, when you get into the chemistry of this, it gets very complicated. Let's see if we can simplify it a little bit. Commercial preparations of essences of sage, hyssop, thuja, cedar have caused human intoxication, including convulsions, in 8 human cases with major symptoms. Okay, so let's just move through this now and leave this as reference material. But I do want to mention that there is an Ayurvedic treatment that is relatively popular that uses essential oil of camphor in a mixture on the head. And so far, what I would say is none of the oils that I have given you are going to be problematic. We haven't talked about using camphor oil. We haven't talked about using hyssop oil. We haven't talked about sage. None of these oils that are potentially dangerous are things that you have been given information about. But now that you know about these oils, you know that they're potentially problematic. So let's just go ahead now and close up this subject of the seizures and go back to the last things that we would like to cover from our wonderful class on the sacred sense. Let's go ahead and back up now and go to the link on Module 14. On the course page, Aromatherapy for Meditation and Spiritual Practices. And if you click on the Pharmacopeia for Module 14, let's just continue where we left off. Now, I want to give you a few more comments about agarwood, cedarwood, cistus, Palo Santo, and sandalwood. Okay, now we left off with Palo Santo. But I want to go back and I want to mention that agarwood is very difficult to get the real thing. It's very expensive. I already said that. But I also want to mention that it is one of the most contaminated essential oils. It is well known in the industry that agarwood oil passes through at least 10 hands between the distiller and the consumer, and that's a lot of opportunity for adulteration. And because it's such an expensive oil, it does get adulterated, finding pure oil directly from a distiller is rather challenging. So I'm very, very cautious about this. We do have some good sources, and I didn't mention any specific sources other than our very limited selection of Floracopia, because really, if you want to get into the world of agarwood, it's a very, very specialized field, really, for the wealthy. And if you're wealthy and you want to get into it, there's some good sources around, but you're always going to be facing the possibility of adulteration and contamination. Now, the wood is less problematic. The oil is really the main thing. A few more things about Palo Santo. Palo Santo is not problematic in terms of quality control. Palo Santo is actually an oil that comes from the wood at a very high yield. And when an oil comes out of a plant at a high yield, that greatly reduces the likelihood of contamination. So rose oil, for example, it takes 7,000 pounds or something like that to get 1 liter of oil. So very low yield, huge amount of plant material. And obviously what's going to happen is the likelihood of adulteration and contamination is extreme because of that. But other oils, such as rosemary, eucalyptus, things that are distilled by the tons and tons and tons, multiple locations in the world, low-cost oils, there's no need to adulterate them. Now, Palo Santo is somewhere in between in terms of its availability. It's not widely available because it comes from one region in the world. It does require these kind of unique conditions for the oil to form, and so therefore the oil does have to be sustainably harvested from the forest, and the forest does need to be replanted. So there's a very long life cycle, and this is the primary issue with it. But distillation of the oil from the forest itself is not a problem, because you can't get oil if you just chop down the tree. You have to pick up the deadwood. And so then the problem is, well, how much deadwood is around? Well, so far, there seems to be plenty of deadwood around, and it seems to be relatively sustainable as a secondary forest product. The main thing I learned in Ecuador that is not sustainable is that they used to chop down the Palo Santo trees and use it for firewood for major industries, such as making bricks or processing fish in canneries and making oils and things like that. They're not doing that anymore. They have upgraded from using the Palo Santo wood, and so that's much less of a risk. Now, Palo Santo as the oil, in my knowledge of the industry, especially since we have a long-standing great friendship with a distiller, and I've been there twice, and we've analyzed the situation, and met all the men who go out in the forest and gather the wood. Since we have a really good idea of our source, I can say there's no quality control issues here. Okay? There may be some quality control issues from other sources, but in this particular case, no. Now, let's look at the next one, sandalwood. I just want to give you a few comments about sandalwood. Sandalwood goes back to the same issues as agarwood, and I would say that sandalwood is even worse than agarwood oil in some ways. I have a mentor who I have traveled around India with several times, and he's a chemist, and he has a company, and they test, when I spoke with him about this many years ago, he said that they test at least 1,000 samples every year in India of sandalwood oil, and what he told me, and this was several years ago, was, quote, almost 100% are synthetic. Now, that's a big challenge, because people go to India and they find sandalwood oil and it smells so nice, and they buy it and they love it, and the likelihood of it being real sandalwood oil is practically nothing. It's practically impossible to get true sandalwood oil. That doesn't mean you can't get it, but the Santalum alba, the true South Indian sandalwood from Mysore and Kerala and Tamil Nadu, that is the oil that is very, very difficult to find. You can still find it. People still get it, but generally it is sold to larger buyers who will show up for an auction at a forestry department where they distill the trees that have fallen down sustainably. They don't cut the trees. They just pick up the deadwood and distill it. And they'll distill 100, 500 kilos at a time, and the big buyers we'll get it. Now, you and I are not going to get that at the retail level. That's the main thing to remember. So, again, when it comes to agarwood and sandalwood and these oils that are very precious, these are things that unless you absolutely know your source, you should not ingest them internally, because the likelihood of ingesting some synthetics is very high. What we offer, two different species from sustainable sources, and that is how we get around the problem. We don't have the Santalum alba from India. We have the Australocaladonicum from Vanuatu, and we have the Spicatum from Australia, and both of these are being managed at the government level for sustainability. So let's look very briefly at sandalwood. What do you want to do with it? Well, first of all, it's incredibly precious, valuable, and so you don't want to be using large amounts of it, because it's going to cost you a fortune. It's a very expensive oil, even from other sources. Like all of these precious oils, my suggestion is you only use it in very small amounts in a contemplative way. Anoint yourself or somebody else and use it fully mindfully. Now, what happens if you anoint yourself with a little bit of sandalwood, pure sandalwood oil, and you just bring, put some on your fingertips and bring them to your nostrils and inhale as part of your meditation practice. Well, sandalwood is said to be the fragrance of sattva. And you know, we have talked about the sattvic mind, and you know its qualities, spiritual qualities of the mind and consciousness that are related very directly to the qualities of the spiritual heart. We could say then that sandalwood, like a lot of these other sacred scents, have a significant supportive, nurturing effect on the spiritual qualities of our consciousness. In other words, they bring out these qualities, and they also help to pacify the rajasic qualities of anger and irritation and agitation, the fiery emotions, and they also tend to uplift us. Now, sandalwood is more calming than uplifting. Sandalwood is definitely relaxing to the nervous system. It helps to calm down the overstimulation of the sympathetic nervous system. So if you have a few drops available, you would like to stretch it out. It blends very nicely with lots of other flowers. If you blend it with rose, you will have a world-class attar. Sandalwood is the basis of the attars, as you will remember, and so you can bring in practically any other exotic flower and you can have a wonderful attar, or you could bring in another exotic substance like an agarwood, as I described last week, and you would have a wonderful spiritual attar. You can then put that mixture into a carrier oil and use it for a massage, and it's going to be absolutely divine. It's going to have very, very positive effects on your mood. And sandalwood is also very good for the skin. So you can put sandalwood oil directly on inflamed skin, and it's going to be a major remedy, but it's very expensive to do that, so I suggest that you put it in a carrier oil that's also very good for the skin, depending on what type of situation that you have. Okay, so sandalwood, very nice, very precious. Use it very sparingly just for meditation. That's my advice. Sandalwood powder is easily available, and in general, it is something that if you want to make an investment in really high-quality sandalwood for incense, it is still a bit expensive, but it's not like the oil. So you can find good quality sandalwood powder in a lot of from a lot of different sources, and it is very, very nice. You just take a pinch of high quality sandalwood and you can put it in the burner, the electric heater that we talked about last week, or you can put it on a coal and it burns very nicely. All right, so that's it on sandalwood. Let's go ahead and look at one of the next ones, which is actually one of my favorite essential oils. I don't use it a lot, but I have a great respect for it, and part of it is emotional memory from being in the island of Corsica several times, and that is the cistus rock rose. So if you could click on the link for cistus, let's go through this very briefly. So cistus rock rose has a long history, and it is because it comes from the resin of the rock rose bushes, and the rock rose bushes grow all over the island of Corsica, along with the other plants in the ecosystem that include sages and rosemaries and myrtle and helichrysum, and it produces this incredible aroma. The island of Corsica is just absolutely beautifully perfumed through the summer. And the rock rose is one of the species that's contributing. Now, historically, what they used to do was that the shepherds would wipe off the, they would trim the hair of their animals, both the sheep and the goats, mostly goats, I believe. The goats would run around in the bushes, and they would get this resin from the rock rose all over them. And then the shepherds, goat herders, would come and they would cut the hair, and they would do these various extracting techniques to get the resin out of the hair, and it became a very famous incense ingredient. And that resin is called labdanum or labdanum, and it goes back a very long ways in the history of perfumery. Now, what is known about this is that it is very therapeutic, and it was discovered, like a lot of things, through contact with the plants and the animals. And the cistus specifically was found by the shepherds, who were always, you know, rubbing this resin off of their animals. They found that it was really good for the skin of the hands. It was very healing to the skin. So that's one of the main things that we see is, if you scroll down the page here, list of therapeutic actions for cistus, skin, it's antioxidant, aging, anti-aging properties, effective in wrinkle treatment, brightens the skin, promotes the skin health overall, and also good for nails and hair. Now, this oil has a very strong fragrance. It's very deep, it's very floral, and it's also got a very interesting, complex, herbaceous kind of aroma that is beautiful in perfumes and beautiful in incense. And here I would like to give you a referral, because if we're going to be talking about exotic perfumes and incenses, then I would like to make you aware of somebody who is doing really interesting work in this department. Now, Floracopia carries the basics. We carry the heaters and the incense burners and the charcoals and the resins and the agar wood and things like that, but we're not making classical incense formulas based on ancient lost scrolls rediscovered in temples and shrines and caves. Well, this person is, and I have thoroughly enjoyed getting a few things from this person. I'll just go ahead and give you the website. If you don't already know it, it's called Mermaid Arts, okay, and that is M-E-R, Mer, Made, M-A-D-E, Arts, mermaidarts.com. I don't usually just give referrals to other websites, but in this case, it's a very specific reason for doing this, and that is that this person is doing exactly what we are talking about with the sacred scents. At a much higher level. And there's a whole world of perfumers who are doing these kind of things, but this is the one that this person is the one that I am most aware of. And if you're really interested, check some of these things out. They're fascinating old formulas. All right, let's see if there's anything else to conclude our discussion about the sacred scents. Let me just scroll through here very quickly about the sacred scents. What else did I want to say? Cistus, okay, you can just go ahead and you can scroll through this. And I think that because of time, we should probably wrap up this particular module. So I've given you an overview. Again, you have a huge amount of material in these monographs. And so let's now shift our attention to moving into the next module. If you have any specific questions or comments about the Sacred Sense module, go ahead and post them now, and we'll include them just in wrapping up this particular section. But for now, let's go ahead and move into Module 15, Officially Essential Oils for Pregnancy, Children, and the Elderly. So let's go ahead and start talking about a very, very big subject. And what we are going to talk about here is, again, confusing and contradictory because of the same reasons. The most fundamental reason is essential oils are new. Essential oils have not been around for thousands of years. If they had been around for thousands of years, there would be very clear understanding, for the most part, or a lot more clarity of understanding about what to do during pregnancy, what to do during childbirth, what to do during infancy, and what to do or not do for the elderly. So the theme of this particular module, let's start it out here in a real focused way. Because of their extremely concentrated nature, essential oils must be used with caution and in special preparations for treatment of sensitive people, including pregnant women, children, and the elderly. So that's how we're approaching this, is that pregnant women, children, and the elderly have unique physiological needs and sensitivities that might make it so that they are more prone to having adverse negative reactions from essential oils, and we should know about that. When the correct species of oils are used in correct dilutions, aromatherapy can be safe and effective for these people and a very beneficial modality for numerous health challenges. So, once again, I am taking both positions. You probably know by now that my position about aromatherapy is both extreme caution, wise use, avoid all problems, and at the same time, it is a very important healing modality that should be in everybody's home. So I embrace the whole thing. I am not a fanatic advocate about one position only. And all we have to know is how do we use these safely? Now, obviously, aromatherapy during pregnancy is a specialized topic. Let's just go ahead and start off with that. Now, if you read the different literature that's out there about aromatherapy during pregnancy, you're going to find that opinions are all over the place. What does that tell us when opinions are all over the place? I'll describe a few of the opinions that I've heard, representing both ends of the spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, we have people that say no form of aromatherapy should be used at any time during pregnancy. All right, well, that's pretty conservative. On the other hand, I have heard people say women can take essential oils internally at any time, even during the first trimester. Well, my personal opinion about that is that that's really unsafe. Why is it unsafe? Well, first of all, there's no historical basis for women consuming pure undiluted essential oils in the first trimester of pregnancy. It just has never been done. It has no basis in any historical evidence that women have been drinking essential oils for hundreds of years. So we don't know. And if we don't know, we should be conservative and cautious. So my opinion is that it is somewhere in between. And I'm just going to give a few other opinions about this from different writers. And you're going to see that a lot of different teachers and writers fall sort of halfway in between with this, and that's where I am on it. And so a lot of people think that the responsible thing to do is not to use essential oils at all during the first trimester. All right, that's pretty safe. Let's back up here a little bit, and let's just immediately rule out internal use of essential oils at all during pregnancy. That is what I will advocate, because you know from this course, I have already ruled that out for everybody. I do not believe anybody should be drinking essential oils unless you have a high level of medical training. They come in very specific forms. You have a diagnosis. You know the health of the GI tract. You're taking it for a specific condition and for a specific length of time, and you are following that person carefully. In other words, you're practicing medicine. So for those of you who are licensed to practice medicine, you can do that if you want. On the other hand, for everybody else who is not licensed to practice medicine, and you don't want to compromise or risk the health of your GI tract, I have advised that we use aromatic plants and herbs internally instead. That's my response. We have plenty of things we can do with essential oils otherwise. You know that. So let's just completely take out the use of essential oils internally during pregnancy. That's our first protocol. No essential oils internally during pregnancy. That, I think, is going to rule out a lot of, it's going to eliminate a lot of risk. Now, what about the external application? I believe that the external use of essential oils in proper dilutions is fine during the later stages of pregnancy and delivery. And I have some good evidence backing that up, okay? Now, what do we know? Another writer says, the use of essential oils is contentious, but it's extremely unlikely that using a few drops of essential oils in a bath is going to hurt the child. Well, all right, let me just modify that. Let's just say a couple drops in the bath in the later stages of pregnancy. Okay. Now, I also want to mention that so far, there seem to be no reports of aborted fetuses, miscarriages, birth defects, or any of these things due to normal use of essential oils from safe applications, inhalation, and so forth. Now, whether there are some reports from people ingesting oils is a different matter, because keep in mind that one of the major things that happens when a woman finds out she's pregnant and does not have access to high-quality medical care is that, and she doesn't want the pregnancy, women will turn to traditional methods all over the world. And one of the oils that has a historical reputation of being an abortifacient is pennyroyal oil. And that is something that we should now consider, is what oils can possibly complicate a pregnancy. Well, that's one of them. But that is not through normal use, normal safe use. That's through women ingesting the essential oil internally. And if we stay away from that, there's not going to be any problems. Now, let me qualify it a bit further, because it gets more complicated. Let's just say that you are in your first trimester. Well, that's not enough information, okay? Let's say you're in your first trimester and it's your third or fourth pregnancy. Well, that's a little more information. Well, let's just say that all your pregnancies have been healthy and you're strong and you are healthy. Well, that's a totally different situation than if this is your third or fourth pregnancy and they have all miscarried, okay? So this is how we have to think. And again, it is not a clear correlation, because we have to think of individual issues here. And so we can't just say, well, is aromatherapy good for pregnancy or not? You have to say, who is the woman? What is her health history? And so what I would say is do not take essential oils at all during pregnancy. I've already said that. I'll say it again. Do not take essential oils at all internally during pregnancy. And what about the first trimester? I would say that this is where it becomes important to understand your health. And if you have had a history of miscarriages, my suggestion would be avoid aromatherapy. And I would also be extremely cautious with herbal medicine as well. And I would say that this is not just because you have the weakness and there's an increased risk of miscarriage. It's also for political reasons, because alternative medicine, natural medicine, is frequently blamed for things that it is not responsible for. And it may have nothing to do with the miscarriage. But if you were taking a particular herb at the time, there's a high likelihood that the doctors would say that herb caused it, that essential oil caused it. And we don't know. That's the problem. We don't know. So in this particular case, I would say use essential oils very, very conservatively in the diffuser and externally, highly diluted, low concentration, during the first trimester if you have good health and no health history of miscarriages. All right. It gets more complicated. Why don't we go ahead and look now at some of the major oils that people agree on? Well, that's a good starting point. But when we really look at this, there's also quite a bit of disagreement about what should not be used. Most of these oils you have not heard of, and that's because I'm not teaching you about all kinds of unsafe oils. I'm giving you oils that are widely used, very safe oils. But the major oils that should not be used at all because of potential toxicity, and you've already started to hear some of these associated with epilepsy, seizures. Okay, here's an oil you should totally avoid: wormwood oil, rue oil. You may not have even heard of these. Oak moss, that's a perfumer's extract. There is the spike lavender, okay? This is a totally different kind of lavender, Lavandula stoechii. And that lavender is very high in camphor compounds, also camphor oil. Parsley seed, sage, hyssop. So you're going to hear these toxic oils over and over again. Now, what oils are generally agreed to be relatively safe? Chamomile, quite safe. Okay, chamomile oil is actually prescribed for massage, highly diluted, low concentrations, for infants. All right, so it's very much the oil that makes the difference. Cardamom oil, frankincense, and geranium, and neroli, patchouli, rose, sandalwood. I think that if you go down that list, you should by now have a fairly intuitive understanding. If I say sandalwood oil, true sandalwood oil, is that a safe, mild oil? Yes, absolutely. Rose, true rose oil, is it safe and mild? Yes. These are oils that are very, very safe during pregnancy. But the list of toxic oils is extremely long, and let's just avoid those throughout all three phases of life we're talking about here. Do not use wintergreen oil, thuja oil, sage, pennyroyal, mugwort, hyssop, camphor, birch. Do not use these oils during pregnancy or even around pregnancy. Do not use these around infants or children, and do not use these around elderly, and do not use these around people who are on serious medications for serious conditions. Okay, so now you can see we're crossing over into the whole discussion about seizures. There's one basic group of oils that are really toxic, and those should be avoided by all these groups of people. Everybody should avoid them, in my opinion. There are very specialized ways to use these oils, okay? But in general, we don't need to. There's really no need. The palette of essential oils that I have given you is very extensive, and each oil has so many different benefits that we really don't need to be dabbling in camphor oil and mugwort oil. Okay, the only two that I have given you that are really problematic, wintergreen and birch. And that's because they are highly effective for musculoskeletal conditions and widely used. But that's also one of the reasons that I gave them to you, is because they're widely used and we do need to know about them. Let's open up some studies here. And if you go to Module 15, you'll see aromatherapy studies for pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum care. Now, this is taking us back to some science, and the language of the science is very tedious, and it takes some time to go through this, but it's very helpful. It is very helpful because it confirms several things. First of all, it confirms that essential oils can be used during pregnancy and childbirth. And we just look at what the studies are telling us. It's very interesting. So if you will now open the file Aromatherapy Studies for Pregnancy, Childbirth, and Postpartum Care, we'll learn some very important applications of oils that you already know. And a couple of these studies you've already seen. So first one, I'm going to go very quickly through all of this. The first one is inhalation of lemon oil for nausea of pregnancy, nausea and vomiting. Conclusion, lemon scent can be effective in reducing nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. Great. So now you know, aromatherapy with citruses is very helpful for nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. That's practical, okay? And is it using essential oils safely or unsafely? Scent, not consuming it internally, okay? Because obviously this is going to be happening mostly in the first trimester. It could go on longer, hopefully not. But the lemon oil is not being consumed. You're not taking the oil as widely as advised. Put drops of lemon oil in water and drink it. That's not how it's being advised. Smell the lemon oil. Okay, the next one is about doing the same thing, but it's studying mint oil for nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. And guess what they found? It doesn't have the same effect. That's very surprising. Let's just keep on going. How about self-prescribed use of aromatherapy oils by pregnant women? Well, this is just a a review that's looking at how women are using aromatherapy in general. And the results are that approximately 15% of the women in this study were already doing aromatherapy themselves. And that's something you find frequently with these studies. They're sociological studies, really. How many people are using aromatherapy? And this one says, our study highlights a considerable use of aromatherapy by pregnant women. All right, that's a very interesting statement. What does that tell us? It tells us that regardless of what science is doing or not doing, that aromatherapy is now becoming a very popular modality of treatment. Okay, what that tells me is that on the one hand, that it is probably generally safe, but it also tells me that there is a great need for education so that this use of aromatherapy is actually in aromatic form and not internally ingested. So the study continues, there is a clear need for greater communication between practitioners and patients regarding the use of aromatherapy oils during pregnancy, as well as a need for healthcare practitioners to be mindful that pregnant women in their care may be using aromatherapy oils, some of which may be unsafe. I think that's a very pragmatic statement. Another study here, the physical and psychological effects of aromatherapy on pregnant women. What is the? How does it end? Aromatherapy inhalation using essential oils containing linalyl acetate and linalool, again, those are the primary compounds from flowers like lavender, and it is found to be effective for the profile of mood states. So it elevates women's moods and parasympathetic nerve activity. All right, so what else do we see? Now we get into some of the other things. Pain and anxiety during second trimester genetic amniocentesis. Well, okay, that's a medical procedure, amniocentesis during the pregnancy. What is the conclusion? Aromatherapy using mint oil was not significantly effective in reducing pain and anxiety during amniocentesis. Interesting information. Let's just skip ahead. What about childbirth? Well, here's inhalation of geranium on anxiety during the first stage of labor. Results. The conclusion, the anxiety score decreased significantly after inhalation of aroma of geranium oil. There was also a significant decrease in diastolic blood pressure. The conclusion, aroma of essential oil of geranium can effectively reduce anxiety during labor and can be recommended as a non-invasive and anti-anxiety aid during childbirth. Great. So now what we see, we've sorted it out a little bit, and we can see that aromatherapy during childbirth is totally different than aromatherapy during the first trimester. First trimester, highly risky, very dangerous if you use the oils internally. But as the pregnancy progresses, and as it stabilizes in the second trimester, and as it develops further in the third trimester, a woman can safely bring back, a step at a time, the use of essential oils in the safe applications. Diffuser during pregnancy, after second or third trimester, fine. Aromatic bath, fine as long as it's properly diluted. Childbirth, aromatic massage, diffuser, direct inhalation, fine. Okay, that's what these studies are pointing to. So I'm hoping that by unpacking it this way, sequentially, that you're going to see that there's a gradient of safety. Now, keep in mind that that is also individualized, okay? And so if the woman has had a history of miscarriages, please modify this, okay? Modify it entirely. Now, another one, aromatherapy with neroli, citrus aranti oil, and anxiety during the first stage of labor. Well, what would you imagine? Conclusions. The results of this study confirmed aromatherapy with neroli oil as a simple, inexpensive, well, I wouldn't agree with that, Non-invasive, definitely, and effective intervention to reduce anxiety during labor. Great, we already know neroli helps to reduce anxiety, and it's perfectly safe during delivery. How about rose oil in a warm foot bath? Well, we don't even need to read through that. We already know the conclusion. Using aromatherapy with rose oil in foot bath reduces anxiety during childbirth. Let's just go ahead and skip ahead now, and what else do we see? We have some other ones past childbirth. Okay, several important things here. Now we have, I was looking for some specific things for the episiotomy. Okay, where is it here? lots of studies on anxiety, lots of studies on the benefits of aromatherapy during childbirth. So don't hesitate to use aromatherapy during childbirth. And don't hesitate to use other methods as well. Herbs can be very, very helpful, especially, and lots of midwives are very well trained now in the herbs that can really prepare the woman for an easy delivery. Black cohosh is one that comes to mind. Helonius comes to mind. Lots of herbs that skilled midwives know about that you should actually start taking if you're pregnant about 2 weeks before the delivery, and it will make the delivery a lot easier. Now, final section here, postpartum. What about psychological effects of aromatherapy massage on healthy postpartum mothers? Well, the results. Results suggest that aromatherapy massage might be an effective intervention for postpartum mothers to improve physical and mental status and to facilitate mother-infant interaction. Well, this is something that Ayurveda has known about for thousands of years, that if you give the mother and the baby a massage, that they're going to be happier and healthier. This doesn't require scientific research. I always love these studies that basically prove what people have always known, and this is one of them. So therefore, aromatherapy massage, very helpful. Now, aromatherapy massage for the mother is going to be somewhat, it's going to have somewhat different concerns than aromatherapy for the infant, of course. But let's just say that in general, as long as you are using highly diluted, low concentrations of very, very safe, non-toxic oils such as flowers, again, rose, lavender, things like that, neroli, sandalwood, just use a very narrow group of oils, small group of oils, very gentle oils, okay? This is not the place where you want to be experimenting with cinnamon, all right? This is not the place where you want to be experimenting with oregano. This is where you want the mildest oils in the lowest concentrations, the highest dilutions with carrier oils. And these are going to be okay for the new mother, and most likely they would be okay for the new baby also. Now we come to episiotomy pain relief, and this is very interesting because what they have found is that essential oils can be applied directly and can be very helpful. So first study concludes, according to these findings, use of lavender oil can be effective in reducing perineal discomfort following episiotomy. It's suggested that lavender essence may be preferably used to betadine, which is a standard thing that they use. Okay, well, there's a couple other things. Lavender oil instead of this other medication, okay? And then lavender and thyme oil for wound care. Now, here's a nice one. Effects of lavender tea on fatigue, depression, and maternal infant attachment in sleep-disturbed postnatal women. How many postnatal women are sleep-disturbed? And how many of them also develop depression and fatigue? And how many of them are affected by that sleep-disturbed fatigue and depression in such a way that it changes the relationship with the infant? Well, that's, you know, it's a very important health topic to consider. But now this study is ridiculously simple. All they say is that if you slow down and you drink a cup of lavender tea, you're going to feel better. Okay, so that's all it says. Another one of those studies pointing out the obvious, that all of these statistics on this questionnaire are going to improve if you just have a cup of lavender tea. And then another study along these lines, the effects of an intervention with drinking chamomile tea on sleep quality and depression in sleep-disturbed women, okay, postnatal women. Same thing. Drink chamomile tea. Chamomile tea may be recommended to postpartum women as a supplementary approach to alleviating depression and sleep quality problems. Post-cesarean pain. Aromatherapy by using lavender is a safe and successful complementary therapy in reducing pain after a C-section. Okay, that's it for studies on aromatherapy for pregnancy, different stages of pregnancy. Let's now move to aromatherapy for children. And again, we have a very complicated topic here. Let me just pull up another file here, if you would. Just wait for me for one moment. Where is my file? Okay. So now, what I would like to cover specifically is before I close up the topic of pregnancy, I just want to mention that you have already received a lot of information on a lot of different conditions that affect women during pregnancy. And you now have the official guidance on how to use aromatherapy safely for those conditions. I'll just give you a few examples. Headaches, migraines. All right, so what are you going to do about that during pregnancy? Okay, so here's the thinking. The woman is having headaches. First question, first trimester, high risk, don't do anything. Okay? Maybe do some simple herbal teas. Just for safety's sake, stay away from essential oils. Okay? Safe, stable, healthy situation, first trimester. Well, maybe a little bit of lavender and a diffuser. Okay? In general, stay away from everything else first trimester. How about headaches during the second trimester? Well, it gets a little safer to start bringing essential oils into aromatic bath and aromatic massage. How about third trimester headaches? It's quite safe to use to use the essential oils in a diffuser and an aromatic bath and aromatherapy massage. And a matter of fact, aromatherapy massage is going to be a very important part of third trimester for many reasons, just because it becomes so much work to carry the baby around, and it's pushing on the organs, and it's causing muscular strain, and so forth. And so therefore, aromatherapy massage using the safe, gentle oils is going to be very helpful. And so therefore, headaches during third trimester, yes, absolutely. Essential oils, lavender, frankincense, chamomile, okay, these are very helpful for massage and for the bath. But you already have the treatments, okay? These things are already in the past modules. I'm just saying that you modify that information. Another example, sore muscles. You go back to the module, musculoskeletal issues, and then you modify it according to the trimester and the woman's health, and you modify the oils. And what are you going to come up with again? Well, you're going to come up with things like lavender, juniper was mentioned. Okay, these oils are very, very safe. Okay, nerve pain, here's another one. These kind of things, again, you modify it. Well, go back to the module on nerve pain. Nerve pain is a primary complaint for a lot of pregnant women. Well, you can find that high dilutions, low concentration of ginger oil could be nice with helichrysum and frankincense. Now, helichrysum is in the category of a blood-moving essential oil, and blood-moving herbs or essential oils is the primary thing that is contraindicated during pregnancy. Why? Because that means emmenagogue. Emmenagogue means it stimulates the uterus. However, that changes during the stages of the pregnancy, and so emmenagogue herbs and essential oils are contraindicated during the first trimester, but a lot of times they become very helpful in the last trimester, okay? And so therefore, low concentration, ginger, frankincense, helichrysum, any of those things that we talked about that help to relieve muscular pain, nerve pain, and you can think again about the herbal-infused oils we talked about, like the St. John's wort oil, the calendula oil, arnica oil, things like that. These things are relatively safe during the last trimester. Okay, and then finally, What about afterwards, stretch marks? Well, okay, this is where you're going to want to use carrier oils a lot for massaging the abdomen. And there's several carrier oils that are very helpful. As a matter of fact, practically any carrier oil is helpful. But cocoa butter could be a good one. Rosehip seed oil is a very good one. Avocado oil, baobab seed oil. These are very, very good. And then, of course, you can add helichrysum, and you can also add the wild carrot seed essential oil. And this is after the delivery, okay? So in the first several months after the newborn, when you're just treating yourself and, you know, you don't have concerns about exposure with the infant. Okay. A few other things. What would you say for balancing hormonal swings during pregnancy and immediately afterwards? Let's just go back and review, put it all in the context of what we've already learned. Chamomile, okay? Any of the flowers, any of the citrus oils, ylang-ylang, okay? You go back and look at the things from the module on women's health issues specifically, and you're going to see the same small group of oils that can now be applied for different issues during pregnancy. Anxiety during pregnancy, what are you going to think of? You're going to think of flowers. You're going to think of neroli. You're going to think of lavender. You're going to think of ylang-ylang. You're going to think of the citruses again. All right. So that's a brief overview. It's a huge topic, of course, but it's a very brief overview, and I'm just focusing on a few narrow things, a small group of oils and the basic principles of how to use them during the pregnancy. Now, we're going to transition here into talking about the use of oils for kids. So now we have gone all the way from talking about epilepsy to talking about meditation and spiritual uses of oils to talking about all the different stages of pregnancy, and I hope that you now have a much better overview of the controversy, lack of understanding, and also what is fairly well established about the safe uses of oils during pregnancy. Now let's talk about kids and what can you do with the kids. Well, here's the same basic conundrum that we're faced with. You have a spectrum of opinions, and those opinions range anywhere from put essential oils undiluted on infants all the way to children should not be exposed to essential oils until they're 10 years old. Well, right away, again, it tells us that there's nothing really well established. It's a lot of opinions. And somewhere along the line, if it's not totally clear, there's no real understanding yet of what the oils can do, somebody's going to get hurt. And that's what's happening, is that people are getting hurt because they're just overdoing it. And so this idea of using oils directly on the skin of children, in my opinion, is a public health hazard. We know you have seen the adverse report reactions. So just as we say, general rule, do not take essential oils internally for pregnancy, we say, general rule, do not give kids essential oils to take internally. Just as we can say that is a general rule, we can now make another general rule, and we can say, do not put essential oils undiluted on infants. Don't do it. There's no need to. It's not going to be beneficial. Now, what about the use of essential oils on children externally? My opinion is do not use them undiluted on children. And you must also have some common sense about the medical situation of the child. All right, and this is where it gets a little bit more complicated. So first of all, we just remove a lot of risk by saying don't take them internally, don't apply them undiluted. That's going to prevent 99% or more of the adverse reactions that children are having. Then let's have a general common sense rule about the health of the child. And this is the same as what I said, common sense, medical approach for the health of the mother. If the woman has had health challenges, she's not healthy, She has a high risk of miscarriage. Just stay away from aromatherapy. That's a specialized aspect of herbal medicine for trained clinicians who can help her to get through the pregnancy safely. Don't add any risk factors. Same thing for the children. We say, okay, is this child healthy to start with? Or is this child really challenged to start with? Now, what we know is that a lot of kids now are coming into the world with a lot of challenges. The parents are unhealthy. The mother has a bad diet. Mother smokes. Okay, well, maybe she quit in time for the pregnancy. Maybe there's been a history of alcoholism, drug abuse. Well, all right, all these things affect the children. And then there's the delivery itself that affects the child. And then there's the onslaught of vaccinations that happens. And vaccinations is a big subject. We don't need to go into it, but I just want to point out that that's where a lot of parents find that their previously healthy child suddenly changes. Linked to autism, we know that. Linked to all kinds of immunological sensitivities. Linked to brain damage. Linked to inflammation. Linked to allergies. All kinds of things happen. And early in life, the kids get sick from strong medical intervention. Now, I also understand that this is a complicated topic, and I can hear people going, yes, but the kids should be vaccinated because they'll pass things around. I'm just pointing out that the kids, when they get vaccinated, they can have adverse reactions. There is no question about that. And children who have had adverse reactions to vaccines are going to be immunologically more reactive to everything. They're going to be more reactive to foods. They're going to be more reactive to essential oils. And so that's why I'm saying we have to make a basic common sense decision here whether to expose a child to essential oils who may have adverse reactions because their immune system is already overly sensitive. Now, a lot of people also report, and this is where it becomes very complicated. I know that I'm probably not making the issue very simple, and that's because it's not. I'm just pointing out the complexities. A lot of parents report that their children used to have a lot of respiratory problems, a lot of allergies, a lot of sleep disturbances, and then they started getting better when they started using aromatherapy. And I totally agree with that. But I would just like to say, go very slowly, especially if the child has a lot of sensitivities in the immune system. Go very slowly. Don't start giving them essential oils internally. And I can't tell you how many shocking stories I have heard. Okay. Here's a recipe for limes for children, and it basically amounts to 20 essential oils per dose taken 4 times a day. That's 80 drops per day, okay? That will cure limes in children. Well, don't use that recipe, please. I'm just giving you an example of a shocking recipe that has been passed around, all right? Well, that's a recipe for liver failure in a child, basically. So go very slowly. How would you like to start? Diffuser is fine. And in general, keep the diffuser away from a newborn. Keep the diffuser away from infants. Just bring it in very, very slowly. And keep in mind that if you do not have a healthy diet, there really isn't even any point in using aromatherapy. Start with the first things first and then build up to aromatherapy. So what does that mean? As a parent, have a healthy diet. And if the child is having health problems, take care of it with the healthy diet first. And do that for the first year or two or three. And then during age 2 or 3, start to bring in a few simple herbs. Start to give them a little bit of tulsi tea, a little chamomile tea for the belly aches and things like that. And then gradually bring in a little bit of essential oil treatment in the form of massage and the diffuser and so forth. And that way, you don't get ahead of yourself where you have an unhealthy lifestyle, you as a parent are unhealthy, the child is unhealthy, and you're trying to go to the strongest form of treatment without taking care of the common sense basic things first. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing, and that's why they're running into problems. You build it sequentially, a step at a time. Okay, that's the general principle. And then there's a whole list of things that you also want to be aware of in general, that you just don't want to use at all. And some of these are really simple. Like, for example, you don't want to be using wintergreen and birch on your children. Okay, you certainly don't want to be using them when they're 2 years old. Wintergreen and birch in a trauma oil may be okay for teenagers, okay, but it's not going to be okay for a two-year-old. That's where the common sense health understanding starts to come in here, okay? The kid's already through puberty, okay? The kid's athletic, okay. Wintergreen and birch, proper dilution, athletic formulas. Just don't let them start to get all, overly enthusiastic about it. Wow, I found this great thing. I'm going to use it like five times a day for the next 6 months, okay? And that's what teenagers will do. Now, I do want to point out that aromatherapy for children and especially for teenagers can be really good. But let me just go through and once again just wrap this up and give the general consensus from a lot of different sources about different age groups. So newborn to 3 months old, okay, avoid all direct essential oil use, and that includes topical, inhalation, anything, all right? Now, in Ayurvedic massage, they have herbal formulas that are cooked in oils, and the babies receive massage, from day one. But that's different than essential oils, all right? The essential oils are more concentrated. So 3 months to 2 years, okay, that's infant to early toddlers. I just want to mention that at this point, you can start to carefully bring in some highly diluted, low concentration oils of the mildest types, and that includes lavender, chamomile. Again, lavender, chamomile, the list is not very long. Neroli would probably be there. Rose would be there again. Okay, we're talking about a small group, a handful of oils here. These can gradually start to come in a massage oil. They can be very helpful. For example, a couple drops of chamomile in low concentration, high dilution as an abdominal massage can be very, very helpful for a two-year-old with a bellyache. You could also just give chamomile tea. Then, 2 years to 5 years, okay, the immune system's developing, there's less risk and all of that. Then you can start to diversify the essential oils a bit more, and you can start bringing in other things like more citruses. That's when you can start to use the orange, bergamot, things like that, lemon. You can start to use in the diffuser some of the stronger oils for colds and flus. You can start to think of some of the conifers. You can start to think of tea tree, things like that. And so wait until they're getting 3, 4, 5 years old before you start doing more extensive aromatherapy. Now, I want to mention just something very interesting here. I'm going to fast forward, and we're going to come back to this again next week, next module, I should say, since we're skipping a week. And I want to mention a very interesting thing just to introduce this. And that is one of the topics in this module, aromatherapy and herbs for ADHD and learning disabilities in children. Now, you already know that essential oils can be used very specifically for enhancing cognitive functions. We had a whole module on that, and we learned a lot of things about oils such as lemon balm for Alzheimer's, dementia, relaxation, concentration, rosemary for improved memory and concentration, and so forth. Now, once the kids are past five, it becomes relatively easy to start bringing a lot of these oils in. And definitely by the time they're 8 or 10, they can be using aromatherapy on an ongoing basis. And that's where you really start to hear a lot of positive reports, okay? It's really tricky doing aromatherapy on kids who are really unhealthy when they're 1 and 2 years old, okay? But once they get to 5, 6, 7, 8, and on, that's where you start to really see, okay, you can see big differences changing the diet. You can see big differences getting them off gluten. You can see big differences starting them on some basic herbs. You can see huge differences using aromatherapy. So that's my general advice, okay? So what we think of then, tying this all together, is the cycle of life, okay? Pregnancy, first part, just minimize everything. Very, very minimal and very, very safe. Second trimester, you can start to move it up. Third trimester, relatively safe to go back to. Overall safe aromatherapy practices. Childbirth, quite safe, okay, for aromatherapy, massage, inhalation, all these things. It's going to be very helpful. And then, postpartum care, very helpful for the mother, but you have to separate the aromatherapy treatment for the mother from the infant to some degree. Then, you think of the infant. Decrease all the aromatherapy. Just focus on healthy lifestyle and diet. Then, once you're past 2 years, you can start to bring things in again. Really focus on healthy lifestyle. And then by the time they get to 5, you can go to natural medicine with very few concerns or worries. Now, to wrap this up, I want to mention that I was involved in supporting a very interesting project in a psychiatric hospital for adolescents and teenagers. And this was a hospital that was really like the worst of the worst. It was a tragic situation where these children came from extremely abused backgrounds, a lot of self-harming, a lot of violence, a lot of addiction. And they ranged in age from 8 or 9 up to 17, 18. And we did a pilot program using essential oils to see if we could have an impact. Well, one of the first challenges was, how are you going to give these kids essential oils if a high percentage of them will do anything to get intoxicated or hurt themselves? So you can't give them a bottle of essential oils because they'll drink it. Or they'll break the glass and they'll cut themselves. You can't even give them a plastic nasal inhaler because they will break the inhaler and cut themselves with the plastic. Okay, that's how serious this was. So what we settled on was we gave them a plastic baggie that had cotton balls that were soaked in essential oils, just a few drops. And this was a very interesting discussion with the administration of the hospital and the therapists. The therapists were totally in love with this because they were all stressed out. And they all got diffusers. Our company basically supported this hospital. They made some purchases, and we gave lots of samples and advised them and so forth. And this went on for almost a year. Excellent results. It never got published. I'll tell you why at the end of this little story. But basically, the therapists were really in love with it. And what they noticed was when they were using the diffusers during their therapy session, with the parents and the children, that the therapy sessions were much less stressful for everybody. People really loved being in the room. They would come in and they would go, wow, what's that fragrance? Well, that's my favorite fragrance, that's lavender, and everybody would be at peace and relaxed. So right away there we can see aromatherapy for psychiatric hospital therapy sessions, really good results. And wide range of oils. The therapist used everything from the citrus oils to the lavender oils to the Palo Santo to the frankincense to all kinds of things. Then we came to, all right, what are we going to give the kids? The way that we decided to do it was not based on what we think is best, but what they liked the most. And you've heard me say that that is one of the principles of aromatherapy. It is not this oil does this, that is most important. It is what do you like the most, because the impact on the olfactory system is highly subjective and you want to have a pleasant response. So I could tell them, well, you know, Jatamansi oil is really going to be good for this, but they're not going to like it. They're not going to use it. And so compliance was number one. And so what we did then was a survey to give kids all kinds of different oils and see what they liked. Guess what they liked the most? Peppermint. So teenagers love peppermint. And they like peppermint for all kinds of different reasons. Okay, it made them feel all kinds of different things, but it's a stimulant, of course. They like that. Some kids like the citruses. Some kids like the lavenders. But a lot of things that the adults like that we know is therapeutic, the kids don't like it, and they respond differently. This is very important. Our sense of smell is different when we're teenagers, and especially when we're teenagers on all kinds of psychiatric medications. That's probably one of the main reasons that they didn't like lavender. They didn't like what was good for them. They liked a stimulant that was really, really strong. So we put this together and we decided, all right, this is the best method. And you can imagine the conversation, because one of the questions that came up was, can the kids take these cotton balls and eat them? Well, of course, they could take the plastic bag and eat it if they wanted. But we decided that finally, all right, you know, something has to, there has to be a compromise here somewhere, and this is the safest way of doing it. So the kids were given individual plastic baggies with their individual fragrance in it, and they were told, use this fragrance when you feel you are having some real difficulty. Well, what does that real difficulty mean? It means that a kid's about to go into a rage and attack somebody. It means that the kid is feeling the urge to self-harm. And so what we did was along the same lines that we have discussed of use the essential oil as a mnemonic device to train yourself to absorb information in a particular way. And so what we found was very helpful is that the use of aromatherapy as a trigger to get the kid to stop what they were about to do and just inhale, just stop and breathe, that in itself was highly effective in stopping unhealthy behavior. And then the effect of the oil also enhanced that. And so the kid would sit down, open their bag, and they were doing this right in the classroom, and, you know, getting great results. We have it all documented. It was never published. But there were over 100 kids that did this. And it must have looked very interesting when these various kids were walking down the hall, they just stop and open the bag and breathe because they felt they needed it. So anyway, just to end our module, I'll say this sadly, this wonderful project came to an end because the risk management department at the hospital felt that it was too risky and the parents might sue the hospital because the kids were using aromatherapy. Now, I always find those situations sad and somewhat paradoxical or contradictory or hypocritical, because the aromatherapy is the least toxic influence on the health of those kids. The background they came from, very toxic, but the parents are afraid of essential oils. The medications, the drug that the kids are on, very toxic, but they're afraid of essential oils. Okay, that's a political statement. I just thought that you might find that interesting. Some of you might be parents. Some of you may have teenage kids. Some of you might like to know. Aromatherapy works really well for teenage kids. Okay, with that, Colleen, I'm going to turn it back to you, and let's see if anybody would like to call in. We have just we'll just give it a minute or two and see if anybody would like to comment or question on anything that I have said about this complicated topic today.
Wonderful. Thank you so, so much, David. So just to let everyone know, please press 1 on your telephone keypad if you'd like to share. And if you're on the webcast, please type directly in box provided. And it's wonderful, David, that you answer all of the webcast questions in between class. That's much appreciation from all of us.
Okay, great.
So far, no one has a question.
Okay. I'll just go ahead and address a few things here. Thank you for sending the links to the medical journals and the statement there is no documented correlation between immunization and autism. That's a controversial topic. Some people say there is no link between immunization and autism, and thousands of parents disagree with that. I have had parents come in who have told me very clearly, my child was very, very healthy. No symptoms, no speech problems, no developmental problems. Went for this particular measles, mumps, you know, the one that I don't remember right offhand, the one that's most problematic, rubella. That night after the injection, ran a high fever, started banging his head on the wall, and ever since then he's been autistic. I've heard that testimonial far too many times. So, yes, of course, there are medical people who say there's no correlation, and then there's lots of people who say there is a correlation. It's been a highly, highly controversial subject. My position on it is everybody should be fully educated. And furthermore, everybody should be able to make a choice. It's a very political subject also, because obviously it's a community type of issue. And, you know, this is not a class about immunizations. It's a class about aromatherapy. I just wanted to point out something that is undoubtedly true, that is seen in clinical practice, and that is that many kids who have been vaccinated have serious immunological problems. That's known, okay? And those immunological problems are relevant to those parents who want to bring in aromatherapy. Okay, so rather than go down the route of arguing, is there a connection or not, should it be done or not, is it good or not, I just want to point out that that kids who have immunological problems need to be treated with more caution with aromatherapy. So, since there are no calls, and since there's a number of questions here that really require much longer answers, I think we can go ahead and sign off. And I will give everybody full answers on the web file, as usual. And I'll give everybody a little homework assignment, and that is, please just read all of the rest of the studies, because there's a couple more files that we didn't get to. And we haven't covered the pharmacopoeia in quite a bit of in quite some time, so I want to just go ahead and encourage everybody to please read through those modules, because I usually leave those to the end if we have any spare time, which we usually don't, because those are things that you can study on your own. They're reference materials. So with that, we'll just go ahead and sign off, and I would like to wish everybody a very good New Year's, because we won't be meeting in the first week of January, and so I'll be talking to you in 2017, and I would just like to say that for those of you who have had a really good 2016, I hope that you have an even better 2017, and for those of you who have had a rough time in 2016, and I know that there's been quite a few people that have reported that it's been a particularly challenging year, I hope that the new year basically is a turning point, and that 2016 completes a cycle of karma that doesn't need to be perpetuated, and that 2017 becomes a wonderful year for you. And I do know that in spite of the global karma and the many disturbing things about the world that are unfolding around us, that it is entirely possible for each person to have increased health, happiness, and well-being in the middle of all of that. And so I will leave you with that final thought. And Colleen, I just want to thank you again for your excellent work every week, week after week, and wish you a happy new year also. And I'll talk to you in the new year.
Wonderful, David. Thank you so, so much for those wonderful wishes for everyone. I'm in 2017. Great. Thank
Great.
You so much.
Yes, and don't forget, everybody, you still have the opportunity to join the breakout groups. And since the class today covered a lot of complicated topics, you may want to check in with fellow students to share experiences, teachings, knowledge, and so forth. And with that, I'll say good night.